Perhaps if we could just go back for a moment when you were referring to Admiral DeWolf, and he was not prepared at that time to get into a full-fledged fight or battle with the RCF for control of maritime aviation. I had run across a document where Admiral DeWolf stated that he wasn't prepared to do battle with the Air Force over the helicopters until such time as the RCN knew exactly what they wanted to procure. This was very sort of early stages. There was a number of aircraft manufacturers out there that were all vying for a contract with the RCN. They were very keen on promoting their particular piece of equipment, and it was all very sort of experimental. Do you think that that would be an accurate assessment of DeWolf at that time, that he wanted to make sure that the RCN knew exactly what they wanted before he would have been prepared to fight with the Air Force?
Oh, I think so, yes. No, I think that's a very reasonable assessment, and a very, very sound one, too. There's no point in getting into a hassle over something that you, in the end, may not be what you want. Although people were enthusiastic about it, were all four helicopters, nevertheless one had to go through an evaluation to see whether they really were what you wanted as part of the arsenal of AS weaponry in the Canadian Navy. And up to that time, the only use for them that was evident was Plain Guard and the Labrador. And about that time, anyway, Harry Dorff decided to get rid of the Labrador, that it wasn't really a naval performance, which caused a little anguish among some people, but really was a very wise decision, because the idea of a icebreaker trying to do battle with submarine in ice was really so ridiculous that it's ludicrous.
During your time at headquarters, there had been this ongoing fight with the Air Force over control of maritime aviation. But at the same time, the Chiefs of Staff Committee, particularly I'm thinking of Folks, was trying to bring or impose upon the three branches of the service standardization, and was very concerned about escalating defense budgets. So in a sense, the RCN was forced to work sort of more closely with the Air Force in terms of evaluation and trials, procurement, for example. Do you remember that period?
No. One didn't know what went on at Chiefs of Staff Committee. Minutes, as you know, are expurgated editions of what really happened. And the Naval Secretary was always a very discreet man. So even after several snorts, you could never persuade him to tell you all the nasty things that were going on in the Chiefs of Staff. I really don't know. But I do know that Harry DeWolf was much admired. He was highly respected and greatly admired, not just because he was very much a combat sailor's sailor, but also for his personal qualities. He was a role model to people like myself and a lot of other people. I had a great regard for him. And his policy of cooperation rather than confrontation might not have appealed to some people, but certainly to people like myself. If Harry DeWolf felt that was the right way to go, then that was the right way to go. And intellectually, you had to agree. When you have a difference of something you want to do. And the person who has opposing views is equally adamant. It's like somebody holding the door that you want to get in. It's no good battering and shouting and screaming and pushing and saying, let me in, let me in. If you lean against the door and stay leaning against the door, sooner or later you have to go and have a pee or something and the door opens. So you get more that way. And I think in the long run, Herr Dorf really got more than by a cut down and drag out confrontation. I don't think this was all imposed by Charles Foulkes as the chairman. I think it was the way that Harry wanted to go too.
All right. During your time as ACNS Warfare and then ACNS Air and Warfare, and the people that were on your staff, was there a great deal of liaison with both the RN and USN as it related to new weapons technology that was coming along?
Oh, yeah. Right from the very start of 1946, we started off following the historical association that the RCN had had with the RN and carried that into naval aviation. So we got an RN carrier and RN aircraft. But there was a trend then towards movement towards the USN and the Royal Navy was starting then in 1946. Supported very much by the then director of plans and operations, my boss, who was Horatio Nelson Lay, and which he carried on when he, in due course, he became ACNS and then VCNS. And it was right too. It was supported by the aviators because, in due course, we went to U.S. Navy training for our naval aviators. And of course they absorbed American ideas. The Americans also had far better carrier aircraft than the Royal Navy did. And were generally far more gung-ho about aviation than the Royal Navy were. So there was a gradual trend that had started in 1946 and then gradually developed and became, till in due course, became almost entirely associated with the USN rather than the RN. But it was certainly ongoing at my time.
During this period when you're in headquarters, the British are experimenting early days of how to employ or embark helicopters in small warships. The Americans are doing the same thing, but the Canadians chose an entirely different path than both the Brits and the Americans. And I assume that they were able to go their own way because they were particularly well informed. They knew what the Brits were doing, they knew what the Americans were doing, and they saw different possibilities. So I assume that they were able to make this informed decision because of the quality of the staff work and the liaison that was going on between the RCN, USN, and RN. Would that be an accurate assessment?
I don't think so. Not entirely. We were... Don't forget that at that time, during the Cold War, we were committed to anti-submarine warfare. We were an anti-submarine warfare navy. Therefore, our guiding principle was the use of helicopters in anti-submarine warfare and their use in small ships, from small ships, to extend the capability of the AS group. I was sure there was a liaison going on with both navies, but we were focused. And I don't recall personally having any major interest in what the others doing, just partly as, just only as a matter of general operational interest. We were very focused on what we wanted to do. The Now this is getting off the track. You've probably heard it all before, but I think the major mistake that the Canadian Navy made as regards aviation was not committing ourselves wholeheartedly to the provision to NATO of AS carrier groups, the combination of aviation and surface in the anti-submarine war that we were expecting to fight. We kept on being preoccupied with escorts rather than, say, a couple of highly efficient carrier groups. Don't forget that we had established a reputation for being effective and efficient anti-submarine fighters, particularly on the aviation side. And we didn't take advantage of this inherent capability that in some way appealed to our flyers and made them so good, and they were good. Time and again they'd outperform the US Navy and the RN Navy too. And we never focused on this instead of fiddling around with escorts all the time. That's a bit of a digression. To go back to, now I don't recall any major close give and take between the three navies on development. We were very focused on our own. We thought it was our idea anyway.
This is true.
Yeah.
And in a sense it was.
Yeah, no.
I mean, the Canadian Navy was able to take this concept from very embryonic stages right through to development of the bear trap in 64 and sell the concept to navies around the world, and it's still in operation today. So very successful program in my estimation. When you talk about, and I will digress a little bit now, when you talk about not being able to get away from the close escort role for the Canadian Navy and take on a wider role, are you talking about carrier support groups as opposed to close escort with carriers?
Yeah.
And can I assume from your comment that you had a personal interest, or the Navy had an interest in acquiring more than one carrier? I know that it was the thing that it was constantly floated by plans throughout the post-war period, acquiring more than one carrier.
Well, the original idea was to have two.
Right.
And one on each coast was pretty damn silly at the time, since we were looking at fighting the next war in Europe, and that the Canadian Navy's role would be as part of SACLAN's forces in supporting that war in Europe. So
I had also come across documents that, at least from a plans perspective, that the Navy was interested in perhaps even procuring a third carrier and embarking nothing but helicopters aboard.
It came later, after my time, I think.
All right.
I don't recall that. No, we would have liked a second carrier, but the money wasn't there. It would have been, I think, more effective to have had a better single carrier. On one occasion, it's when I was director of plans, after I went back to Ottawa after my first stint at the National Defence College, I'd gone over to England to a meeting and had taken out the Royal Navy Director of Plans to lunch. And we went to a place called the Travellers Club, which was supposed to be a very posh London club. I got a card to it from the club I belonged to in Ottawa at the time, and that place was ghastly. It hadn't had a thing done to it since Victorian days. It smelt musty. heavy, dark furniture. And this was in 1949 or 50, I think. And things were still pretty bleak in England at that time. So we had a couple of drinks and we went into lunch. And there were two choices for lunch. There was boiled mutton and boiled cod, boiled potatoes and boiled cabbage, with each all sweetened water. It was awful. And I was feeling terrible about this, and suddenly thought, well, this isn't my bloody club, it's his bloody London, not mine. But anyway, we were talking about carriers, and I think after two good hefty gins and then a bottle of wine, he became loosened up a bit. And he said, where the hell are you buying this stupid Bonaventure you've got? He said, those things are no damn good anyway. So you're spending all this money on a thing that isn't any really very much better than the Magnus. So he said, if you'd asked us, we would have lent you a Hermes class carrier, which was bigger, better seaworthy, could fly off aircraft in weather that the Magnificent and the Bonaventure just couldn't touch. And he got quite annoyed with me last year about this going on and on. So anyway, I took it all, and then after, as soon as the time frame was right, I phoned up my boss, Nelson Lay, and said, look, this is the situation, and the director of plans has confirmed that they would lend us one if we asked. So anyway, apparently he went to see the CNS, I forget who it was, then. And it was talked about, and they decided that it was politically out of the question. We'd spent so much money on the Bonaventure that they couldn't turn around to the government and say, we don't want this bucket of rust, throw it away, we've got a better one. So that died. And then the US Navy unofficially said that they would lend us, or give us, an Essex-class carrier. But I think that was just too big, too expensive. We couldn't have done it, handled it financially.
I'd come across some documents, and the USN, I think there was some nominal fee attached to it. I think it was $4 million something for an Essex-class carrier, completely outfitted, which was, as it turned out, substantially less than what the refit was for Bonnie when it was all said and done, and then only to be, you know, scrapped. That's by right. By the government shortly after coming out of refit.
Yeah.
But this sort of leads to the next question. It has been suggested that the RCN was as successful as it was in its many endeavors in the post-war period, thinking of towed array, for example, the hydrofoil, at least as a concept, the marriage of the Sea King helicopters to the destroyers and the DDH concept, due in part because of the small size of the RCN, and also due in part to the budget. I mean, the RCN had to do with so little in comparison to the Air Force that they were forced to be particularly innovative. Would you think that that's a fairly accurate assessment of the post-war RCN? Doing more with less and...
Oh, I suppose so. Well, we certainly have to do more with less and improvise. And for instance, we maintained our aircraft at a perfectly, it's an excellent state of operational fitness on a fraction of the number of maintenance members in the RCA fields. But I think it was more, perhaps, in my view anyway, to the fact that we had set up a scientific section, if you liked. We had the Bedford Institute, which was very active, was strongly supported by the Navy, and they were urged to look for things like the variable depth sonar in the middle of that, and encouraged and given the money to do it. Because since our focus of interest was in anti-submarine warfare, and obviously anti-submarine technology was wholly inadequate to what it was supposed to do. It was very much in the Navy's interest to try and improve this. We had this Bedford Institute and all these scientists and engineers doing this kind of work, and it was good to encourage them. There was support and interest, I think, right throughout the Navy for that, and naturally they reacted to this, as people do. And I think it was perhaps as much there in that as anything else. And there's always a challenge when you, to go back to your theme, that when you have to do something with on a shoestring, you tend to get on and do it. But it was very successful. The bear lips started, the bear trap, things like that. The hydrofoil, I think there was a certain amount of emotionalism in that, because I think the operational concept wasn't that bright. The idea of these things little bobbing around all over the place in the middle of the ocean and then roaring off at vast speed to wherever there was a punch-up of some kind, I'm not too sure that that was really sound. But I thought there was a bit of emotionalism about it because of Brando and Bell and the fact that we had produced the original hydrofoil. It was obviously a way to go.
Right.
And there was a lot of interest in enthusiasm. It was fun, too, a great thing. But operationally, I don't think really it was.
I would have to agree with that assessment. It's just that when I think about the hydrofoil, I know that the RCN was able to accomplish things that even the larger and better funded USN wasn't able to do when they were working on similar hydrofoil projects themselves, and the RCN certainly seemed to have the technical and engineering expertise during the post-war period, and could get it right when frequently the Americans or the Brits couldn't get it right, as it related to the foils, for example, and there's countless examples, I guess, as it relates to the helicopters too. The Canadians could get it right, but the RN couldn't, and the Americans were experimenting with their drone remote-controlled helicopters, which didn't turn out to be a very successful program at all.
I think that in the case of the Brits, they probably have thought, well, this is a lot of nonsense anyway, it isn't operationally sound, it's a concept, but I guess we have to go along with it. They didn't have that emotional urge that we had here.
I just have one last question for you. I would like to get your thoughts on or your impressions as to the quality of the staff work that was being done at headquarters during your tenure as ACNS Warfare and ACNS Air and Warfare. General comment about the people at that time. My impression is that the RCN had some very good officers and were very thorough and efficient.
We had some very good individuals, yes, but the RCN did not place very much emphasis on trained staff working, on structured staff work. We sent people to Staff College rather grudgingly. And it wasn't part of an officer's career pattern, an essential part of an officer's career pattern, the way it is in the Army. An Army officer cannot be promoted unless he's PSC. That was not so. We intend to place reliance on improvisation rather than a structured piece of staff work. And this was a mistake. And I think we suffered from it.
Could you give me an example, or when you say that we suffered?
No, I don't think I can. We did very well with off-the-cuff improvisation in staff work. I cannot say that I can ever recall that we suffered from it in a wrong decision. I know I felt that with personally, because when you are trained to produce a staff solution of a battlefield problem, it is a hell of a lot easier when you can go through a series of steps that everybody else is taking to produce a final solution which is presented to the commander, that he can absorb and make a decision on, because they're all done the same way and come together, rather than a whole series of more or less narrative proposals, all in different styles and with different approaches. Now, the army have to do that because their decisions are often made under the most difficult circumstances, in mud, wet, rain, under tremendous stress and under pressure. So it's easier when you have a series of structured steps to go through to reach your decision or to reach your recommendation for the commander. We perhaps don't have quite that kind of stress that the army do, and maybe we don't therefore have quite that same urgency for an organized staff procedure. But nevertheless, I think that in the long run, it may make for easier working and perhaps clearer decisions.
Well,
or at least clearer material on which to base, if you have an organized, similar system right through the battle pattern. Now, there's just one thing that has come to my mind. When I went in 1946, when I became the deputy director of plans to Horatio Nelson Lay, as a matter of fact, we got on very well together. He was an odd man. He was most difficult to work with. But then, in many ways, he was quite charming. He used to invite my wife and I, and maybe a couple of the others, to go to his house in the evening. And we'd play Vantiana until all hours of the night. And get absolutely plastered, the whole lot of us. It was a lot of fun. But he was difficult. He went off to the atomic bomb trials at Beacon, the American Navy did. And about a week before he was due to go, he sent me, he said, I can go to Beacon and I'll be away for about a month or so. And he said, on such and such a day, I've got to go and lecture the Army Staff College on naval strategy and tactics. And he said, you'll have to do it for me. So I said, fine. So could I have your lecture notes and I'll just do that? He said, lecture notes? Oh, I don't use lecture notes. I don't need them. So there was a lot of balls, of course, isn't it? So I went away and thought a bit. I hadn't the faintest idea what naval strategy and tactics were. I'd been a reservist. Nobody had ever told me about those things. So, or I went to the library, and all I could find in the library was the Battle of Tsushima, the Battle of Jutland, and this kind of thing. Of course, it never occurred to me. I was in a hell of a panic then. I was staying up until 2, 3 in the morning, not going home. Sometimes I didn't even go for breakfast, trying to produce something. Well, I eventually cobbled up something that was pretty god-awful. Well, I was lucky, because at the Army Staff College, it was one of the early ones after Europe, and there were all these guys who'd been brigadiers, colonels, who'd been bumped back down after the war, starting off again. People like Bill Anderson, all these tough guys who'd been through North Africa, Italy, you name it, commanded brigades, even divisions. And it was an after lunch. They'd all had several drinks, and they all went to sleep. So it didn't matter what I said, nobody was listening anyway. So that was all. Anyway, I digress. What the hell was I talking about in the first place?
Staff work,
yeah.
No,
wait a minute, let me just finish that bit. I inherited a thing that had been written in 1944 by a fellow called Hodson, I think it was, on the composition of the fleet after the war. And this was to fulfill the aspirations of the Old Guard Navy to have a more or less bigger ship navy, not a bunch of corvettes and things like that. So we had a couple of cruisers, a couple of aircraft carriers, tribal class destroyers, and that kind of totally unsuited for North Atlantic. And this was what the Navy was going to be. Then things started to focus that the next enemy was the Soviet Union. We weren't allowed to talk about that. Although when the Military Cooperation Committee went down to for meetings in Washington, it was perfectly open to the U.S. forces that they were preparing for war with the Russians.
Right.
But oh no, we mustn't talk about it. So it was a long time.